for my life, but I think I wanted to protect Tova so much that she was hidden too deep in my thoughts for the ocean to see. I didn't think of anything but surviving then. Later, I mastered keeping the secret from her by pushing thoughts of Tova away when I was with her, just like you've done with this boy. And because I wanted so much to hold on to Tova, I didn't forget her. Aisling beamed, proud of keeping this monumental news to herself for a century. "Were you married?" I guessed, still in shock. "No," she said flatly. "Tova's father didn't stick around. He said he loved me, but the moment I told him I was pregnant, he disappeared. I don't remember his name anymore." She swallowed, pulling her memories together. "My parents turned me out, ashamed. I was sent to live with my aunt and uncle in the north. They had no children and were pleased to have me, even though I'd been disgraced. And when Tova came," Aisling sighed, "she made the whole world brighter. I was glad her father didn't want her, because it meant she was all mine." Her joy turned to sadness almost instantly. "I'd gotten a letter from my parents wanting to make amends. Tova and I were going to travel by steamer and, I hoped, be reconciled with my family. I knew once they saw how beautiful she was, they'd adore her. So the plans were all set. Then Tova got sick. She seemed healthy enough by the time we were supposed to leave, but I didn't want to risk having her travel before I was sure she was fully recovered. Easily the best decision I ever made." "So she lived?" Aisling nodded. "She grew up with my aunt and uncle. I don't know why my parents didn't take her. It's not as if I could ask. From time to time, I'd go back, wear my hair under a kerchief or dress as an old lady. I watched my daughter grow up and fall in love and have a family. I've had her whole life, and I couldn't ask for more. Well," she amended, "I shouldn't ask for more." Aisling stared into the sand, seeing years and years of other people's lives contained within her own. She was, I thought, quite possibly the most extraordinary siren that had ever lived. "I'm telling you this for several reasons. First, so you will understand my departure plan and see it through to the end. Second, so you can trust that I will take your secret out of this life with me. And third, so I can explain to you what you must do next." I didn't dare hope that there was a way to get back to Akinlee, but if Aisling had done all that she'd just told me, maybe there was a chance. "The ocean says she doesn't take wives. She says she doesn't take mothers. I've been a mother, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother, and I've never failed at serving her." I absorbed those words, seeing the last 80 years in a new light. Aisling had never forgotten her own past. She had kept the attachments of her human life, taken time away from us so that she could follow her daughter's life. And yet she'd performed her work so flawlessly that the ocean had never questioned her devotion. Aisling was proof the ocean wasn't always right. "If this boy is that important to you, you have to take what you can get. You might not be able to be with him again. You might have to endure him marrying someone else. But you can go and see him. Dye your hair from time to time. Dress like you're older than you are. It is possible to watch someone without being seen. Let him live his life and be happy for him. If you can be satisfied with that, then find a way. If not," she shook her head, "then please, for everyone's sake, let him go." I nodded, knowing she truly understood. "Thank you, Aisling. You've changed everything." "Tell no one." I took her hand and held it in mine, promising, "Never." 11. On Christmas Eve, the ocean took us all back to Sweden with Aisling, just as she wished. She wanted to spend one last night in her tiny cottage that she loves so much before being changed back. Then the others and I would set her up in her new life as best as we could. There were no guarantees once she was human again. "So we'll leave the bed for you for tonight," Miekka said. "And those are the clothes you picked out?" Aisling looked over to the small leather backpack she'd set in the corner and the clean dress and tights she'd hung up just above it. Yes. Her voice was meek, tired. Why are you so down? Elizabeth asked, twirling to admire the shimmer of her sea salt dress. You should be celebrating, right? It's Christmas and you're getting the best present ever. Aren't you excited? Aisling nodded. Of course. It's strange is all.
I'm going to start cooking, Miyaka said. I think a final meal will do us all good.
Can I help? Padma asked, clearly looking to find a way to fit into the group. I imagined this was difficult for her, attending the departure of a sister she'd only known for a few weeks.
Of course, Miyaka replied. I'm putting everyone to work.
Not Colin, Aisling said. I need her for a moment.
Sure, whatever you want.
Aisling and I changed out of our sea salt dresses and into something more conventional before stepping outside. I could see her taking care with each movement, as if she were studying herself. She put on tall boots and gloves and even a hat, encouraging me to do the same. I knew then that I might be delving into more of her secrets. The snow was merely frozen water, natural water, that all linked back to the ocean. A rogue toe in a mud puddle was enough for us to communicate with her, whether we needed to or not. Today, she was going to be out of our touch until Aisling decided differently. Our breath hung in the air as we stood under the canopy of branches that shielded the little house. Aisling was still, her face tensing more and more by the moment. So, what do you need me for? I asked. She swallowed, trying to maintain her smile.
Someone has to know where to take me. Come, I have a few details to tend to along the way.
Aisling didn't seem to want to speak, so I followed her in silence, the crunch of our shoes on the snow the only sound. We walked for quite a while before I started seeing signs of the town, a rural area just in from the coast. We passed small houses attached to large farms first, then a few shops and some apartment buildings, and finally came to a beautiful town square. After all the large cities in which we'd lived, it was hard to believe a place this quaint and rustic was real. Twinkle lights were hanging from trees, and the small shops had decorations in their windows. Children ran down the street in their wool coats, singing carols as if they were battle cries. The scent of cinnamon and citrus filled the air, and I was glad this was the way I'd see Aisling's final home. I got her attention and signed to her. I can see why you like it here. Her face was still tinged with sadness.
Part of me fears I won't like it after.
Nonsense. This is you. Near the edge of town, Aisling gave me some money and asked me to go into the corner shop for flowers. I was confused by the request, but did it all the same, returning with dark red flowers I didn't know the name of. She thanked me and took them, marching onward out of the bustle of the town. Aisling walked with sure steps, knowing the path well. I followed her at a distance, sensing this was hallowed ground. As we came upon the graveyard, she paused, her hand on the post, collecting her strength before carrying on. There were other footprints in the snow, proof of families visiting their kin on this very special holiday. When she came across the slightly weathered headstone, she stopped, picked up the dried flowers that presumably she'd brought on her last visit, and set the new ones in their place. I studied the dates and realized Aisling's daughter had been dead 26 years. I tried to remember exactly what we were doing then. Did Aisling ever let it show that she'd just gone through the most devastating thing a mother could? How did she keep living when Tova was gone? After a few moments of silence, Aisling's shoulders began to shake. She looked around nervously, and I did the same. We were alone. When she was finally sure of it, she let out an anguished cry, and I rushed over to wrap my arms around her. It's okay, Aisling. She got to live her life. She got that because of you. I'm not sad that she's gone, she wept, wiping her tears with the back of her hand. I'm sad because after tomorrow, I won't even know that she lived. She let out a pained, guttural moan, doubling over and grasping her daughter's gravestone. I realized then that in the last 100 years, this was the closest she'd ever been to holding her child. And she'd never do it again. I had always thought forgetting would be a blessing, but now, for Aisling's sake, I wished a little could stay. A familiar word caught my eye, and I turned to the stone on one side of Tova's. It marked the short life of Aisling Evanson. I wondered what her family had put in there to represent the girl they'd lost. She brushed off her face and smoothed out her hair.
I just wanted to tell her I loved her one last time.
If your great-granddaughter is named after you, then I'm sure she always knew. Aisling smiled a bit.
Thank you.
She leaned her head into mine, and we stayed like that for a minute. I couldn't begin to imagine all the thoughts going through her head, and my only hope for the rest of her life as a siren was to make everything simple and painless.
I'm ready, she whispered.
We stood together and started walking. Aisling didn't look back.
There's a boarding school in town. I want to be left there.
At a boarding school? Are you sure?
Yes.
She kept her eyes straight ahead as she spoke.
You'll need to write a letter for me, explaining why you had to abandon your sister. But I've got enough money saved for 2 years of tuition, which is more than I need. I'm hoping that the town will just accept me as one of their own by the time I graduate, and then I can find a job working here.
I considered her plan. It seemed so ordinary. Do you not have any other passions or pursuits? Isn't there anything else you want? She shook her head.
My great-granddaughter teaches at that school. All I want is to have a chance to be one of her students and live and die where my family did. Anything after that is more than enough.
Did you really hide yourself so well all this time that no one will notice? Finally, she laughed.
I spent plenty of time away with you all, and I've lived in other places. I visited this area only once or twice a year. Not to mention that I've reinvented myself more than you could guess. Besides, the town's not so small that everyone knows everyone. Stay out of the way, and it's easy to blend into the background.
You'll make quite the Christmas surprise, I mused. She smiled.
I see the girls there, and some of them seem sad to be in the same place all year. They don't have anywhere to go for the holidays. I think it will actually be fun for them, someone new showing up on Christmas. And once they all hear my story, it might give them something to be grateful for.
How do you mean?
She shrugged. I'll be the girl with no family. Whatever they're going through, it will be better than that.
There was something close to pride in her voice, as if she was happy to give this to others despite knowing how people would talk. I'm really impressed, Aisling, with your plans, with how you've lived your life. I can't believe this is possible.
Now you know it is,
she replied with a smile.
Speaking of which, have you made any decisions about attempting something like this yourself?
No, not yet. I feel like if I tried, I could be as clever as you, but I'm not sure I could be as strong. She wrapped an arm around me.
You have more strength than you know. Trust me.
We got closer to town and fell silent. Aisling pointed out the boarding school, noting which door we should use. The school was actually kind of pretty, with its white walls and tall windows. A few girls sat on the steps in their uniforms, braving the cold with cups of steaming cider, and I pictured Aisling in that spot, laughing with friends. I hope she would never be sad about waking up without her memories. For her sake, I tried to infuse the night with as much happiness as I could. We didn't give her presents, knowing she couldn't take much with her, but we filled her up with food before we all walked into the ocean together.
Goodbye, Aisling. You served me so well.
I'm happy you think so, she answered, her voice full of gratitude. And thank you for this astonishing life. It was more than I could have asked for.
You're welcome. Are you ready?
She swallowed once.
Yes.
Close your eyes.
She did, but they jerked open a moment later as the liquid was forced out of her. Aisling writhed, gripping at her neck as if she were trying to fight off strangling hands. Her arms and legs flailed violently until she finally went limp, and the girls and I swam to rush her unconscious body out of the water. Headmaster Strout, please take care of our beloved sister, Aisling. For reasons we cannot articulate here, we have been forced to part ways. In her bag, you will find tuition money, and once she is enrolled, we are sure you will find her to be a bright, diligent, and excellent student. We realize this request is a bit unorthodox, but please, we beg you, see it through. This is the best that we can do for her. And to Aisling, our guide and strength, please move forward in life knowing that you are loved beyond anything most souls would know. We wish you every happiness in life and hope you will walk on in complete and unspoiled joy. You are in our hearts always. Love, your sisters. 12. The others went back to the ocean, but I stayed, watching from the shelter of a group of trees near the school until Aisling woke up. It was before dawn when she stirred, clearly disoriented. She cried a little, and eventually someone heard her. She clutched herself tightly as an older woman walked her into the school. Once she was safely inside, I started walking. The cemetery was deserted on Christmas morning. I knelt in front of Tova's grave and pulled a few flowers out of the bouquet we'd left her the day before. I didn't think she'd mind sharing with her mother. I left them on Aisling's grave, knowing now that this girl was truly gone. I pulled up my hood as a fresh snow began to fall and made my way to the ocean. Swimming back to South Carolina felt lonely. I'd already seen Marilyn and Nombiko go through their changes, but this time felt different.
Of course it does,
the ocean said, reading my thoughts.
She's been with you the longest. It'll be the same for Miyaka when she does this for you.
That makes sense, I allowed. It's just that it feels like we're missing something now.
She kept to herself so much. I'm sure once you get home and get back to teaching Padma, it will feel as if nothing's changed.
I hope so. At home, everyone was in a jolly mood and doling out presents to one another. You have a pile over here, Miyaka crowed, begging me to join. I know, and I have some for you too, but I need to get into dry clothes. Save me some cookies. I can't promise that, Elizabeth yelled. I chuckled and went into my room to shower and change, trying to shrug off my sadness over losing Aisling and prepare myself for everything to come. It was Christmas, after all, so I decided to give myself one tiny present. Digging my phone out of my faithful wooden trunk, I powered it up for the first time in months. I was thrilled to see I had messages waiting. Akinley's two texts from our last night together were still there, but there were others after it. The first one was a few days later.
Kate girl, you there? Sorry if I did something wrong. Come by the library sometime.
That one sent a pang of guilt through me. I hated him thinking my leaving was his fault. He'd been nothing but kind. Heaving a sigh, I moved on to the next one.
Hey, you there? Could use a good listener right now. Text if you can.
I considered that one for a while. I liked listening to him when he talked about the inconsequential, and I wished I had been there to listen to him if he truly needed it. I swallowed, moving on.
Sorry, no, this is random. Had cake today. It was crap. Anyway, hope you're doing okay.
That was the last one, dated about a month ago. I smiled at the words. I was glad it was only 5 messages and not one for every day we'd been apart. It was enough to show he thought of me from time to time. Maybe he'd remember me down the road, whatever life he lived, as that girl he'd met one time who he baked a cake with and who knew how to jitterbug. My heart lifted at the thought. That last night, in the dorm hallway, I thought it would be easier if he forgot me before I forgot him. Now I had a sense that even after his name and face were wiped from my mind, there was a chance I wouldn't be wiped from his. In the weeks after Aisling left, things did begin to get back to normal, but not in the ways I had hoped. While I found myself loving Padma, just as I loved my other sisters,
The novelty of her presence in the house wore off, and I began to spend more and more time in my room again, alone. Honestly, there were days when her mood seemed as somber as mine, and being in her presence only magnified my anxieties. I tried not to think of the singing, which was so close now. I could feel her pain, her aching hunger. She would hold off as long as she could, for our sakes, but it wouldn't be much longer. I tried to forget about the future and threw myself into research, scouring the internet for the last passenger of the Arcacia, and I finally found him. Robert Temlow, 53, an insurance salesman. A picture of his thin, tanned face went into my scrapbook, completing a passenger list for the first time. I closed the book, thinking I'd feel something. Accomplishment? Satisfaction? But nothing came. It was a familiar emptiness. One of my first research projects had been on sirens, when I had been with my sisters for only a few years. I had tried to learn everything I could about my new life. I dug out those old notes and went through them once again. I had found a wealth of art and more short stories than I would have imagined, and in general, there was some truth to many of the pieces. In several places, the number of sirens was said to be 2, in others, 5, and those were indeed our limits. It was an impossible job to do alone, but having too many at once increased our chances of exposure. A lot of what I read was absurd. I rolled my eyes at the descriptions of women with the bodies of birds, flinched at the artists who turned us into fetishes. But then I thought of Elizabeth, quietly luring boys into bed, and knew it wasn't completely far-fetched. Nowhere did it mention how we serve the ocean or that sirens didn't exactly want to be in this position. No one explained how it all began. There wasn't a single piece that advised how to escape from this sentence. I had been so desperate in the beginning, longing for some kind of answer. The ocean became the only truth I knew. Nothing made sense but her. I pushed my notes away and flung myself into the oversized chair in the corner, looking out at the water. I found myself missing Aisling, which felt silly after us being apart most of the time anyway. Maybe it was just because, for a small period of time, she was the only one who understood what I was feeling. She made me feel less isolated in my sadness. As I stared at the breaking waves, I found myself wondering if Akinley was doing the exact same thing right now. He said he grew up in a little fishing town in Maine, Port Clyde. Maybe at this very moment, he was sitting with his parents, drinking hot chocolate and watching sleepy waves roll in. Or perhaps they were finishing up those holiday trips to see extended family that everyone seemed obligated to take this time of year. I was willing to bet he was wearing a hideous sweater from some great aunt just so he wouldn't hurt her feelings. Or maybe he was already packing, getting ready to head out of the blustery winter up north to the milder weather of Florida. Maybe he'd picked a major by now and was so excited to get back to school, he couldn't stand it. I wonder if Neil had gotten any easier to live with, or if he was still making trash sculptures in the corners of their room. Maybe, just maybe, once in a while he would go by the tree we sat under, waiting to see if I'd show up. I was so tired of crying, so tired of salt water, but it seemed unavoidable. If I wasn't going to swim in it, it would flood out of my body instead. I wanted to go to him so bad. I felt like I owed him an apology for leaving the way I did, for not having my phone on that one time he needed to talk, for walking into his life in the first place. And it hurt feeling this growing, heavy thing in my chest for him and not knowing if any of it was reciprocated. It was all too much at once. Aisling was gone, but I still needed to keep her secret. I had a new sister who seemed as stuck in her past life as if it was still happening. I loved and hated the ocean at the same time. And I missed Akinley so deeply that it weighed down my unbreakable bones. I turned away from the ocean, tucking myself into bed. I didn't need to sleep, but I wanted everything to stop for a while. When I woke after a mercifully dreamless sleep, I could hear my sisters discussing me in the living room. "It's not you she's avoiding," Elizabeth said, and I could tell from the gentle note in her voice that she was talking to Padma. "She just gets like this." "She's served the ocean longer than any of us," Mieka added. "It's hard for her. We just need to give her space."
Climbing out of bed, I looked at the floral-patterned curtains, the bland pictures on the walls of my room, and suddenly hated them. This house felt like a trap. I'd fled here to get away from my hopeless love for Akinlee, but I hadn't gotten away from myself. I opened the door of my room, and my sisters fell silent as I came to join them. Miyaka and Elizabeth looked embarrassed, and I knew they were wondering if I had overheard them discussing me. "I think it's time to move again," I told them. 13. The new year came and went, just the same as all the others, and no ship sank. February came, and no tsunami swept anyone into the ocean. March passed, and there were no floods. As we crossed into April, the inevitability of singing again became more and more real, and that familiar dread filled my body. The ocean could hold back between shipwrecks for a year at most, her hunger increasing with each full moon, and it had been almost a year now. I bought a brand new scrapbook and braced myself. I heard the ocean's hunger in every crash of a wave, every hiss on the sand. It felt like an ache in my own body, which made sense as she was actually in me. But yearning to ease that pain in myself did nothing to make the coming singing any more desirable. "Where would you want to go, Elizabeth? You haven't picked anywhere in a while," Miyaka offered. True to my word, this time we were planning before we found a new home. "I'd go back to Miami, but I'm assuming it's out of the question." She eyed me. It was spring, so he'd be back in school now. I could wear my hair under a hat and buy some blue jeans. If I stayed far enough away, he'd never notice. But how could I stay away? "I don't think that'd be a good idea." I scribbled circles on the pad of paper we were using to brainstorm. I couldn't even put down the name of the city. "What's in Miami?" Padma wondered. "Beaches," I answered quickly. "What about you? If you could go anywhere in the world, where would it be?"
"New York City. I want to see the lady." Padma held her arm up in the air.
"The Statue of Liberty?" I asked.
"Yes, I've always wanted to see her."
Her eyes widened, and she tipped her head back as if she could see it already. "I told my father once when I was little that I wanted to go there to see the green statue. He slapped my face and said all I would ever see is the inside of my husband's home. Said that was all I was fit for." She held herself together for a few seconds before she crumbled and the tears started. I got the feeling that when Padma had these moments of remembering her abuse, it wasn't simply that single instance filling her head, but dozens and dozens of them piling on her until she cracked under the weight of them. It was troubling, to say the least.
"I thought you said I would forget. Why is he still here?"
Padma demanded.
"It will go," Miyaka promised, hugging her new sister. "But if you hold on, it can stay longer than you want. You have to let it go."
I motioned to Elizabeth. That's why she remembered more than any of us. And Aisling had things she held close to her as well.
"Really?"
Miyaka asked. "Yes, she kept most of it to herself, but there were huge pieces of her past life that stayed." I placed my hand on Padma's. "We understand that your father's abuse was a big part of your life. That's why it clings to you so terribly. But if you let it stop mattering, that will help."
"Do you think I want this to matter?"
she yelled, ripping herself away from us and shoving the chair to the floor in the process. Padma stared us all down for a moment before turning away.
"Here I am, beautiful, immortal, and all I can think about is that he gets away with killing me. He'll never suffer for what he's done. It's so unfair."
"It is terribly unfair," Elizabeth said fiercely, grasping Padma's hand.
"But all you can do now is rejoice in your new freedom. He can never hurt you again. He has no power over you."
New York City was a terrible idea. Yes, there was plenty of water around, but it wasn't exactly easy to get to without being seen. And even in the safety of an apartment, the walls might not be thick enough to hold our voices in, to protect the people around us. And yet, if it would ease some of Padma's pain...
"Padma," I began, "you can prove your father wrong on at least one point.
Do you want to go live in New York for a while? She turned back to us.
Really?
Elizabeth smiled.
Of course. New sister gets to pick the new town. It's kind of a rule, she lied.
Padma covered her mouth with her hands, completely in shock.
You're not joking with me, are you?
Not at all.
Miyuka opened her laptop.
I'll see if I can find us a nice apartment close to the water.
Don't be afraid to look outside of Manhattan, Elizabeth said. We can still go into the city, like, all the time.
Any level of privacy would be nice. We don't want to have to be rude to the neighbors so they don't bother us, I said. And we'll have to be very careful that no one hears us.
Can we find one where I can actually see the Statue of Liberty every night?
Guys, Miyuka said, placing her arms up in front of her and giving us a cocky grin.
A little bit of trust, please. I will find us a wonderful home.
Padma squealed and spun around and around, temporarily forgetting all her past hurts. Within the next 2 days, depending on where the ocean found a ship, we would head off to sing. I hoped that the promise of this new adventure would outweigh the sorrow of her first song and of the life I wish she would put behind her. Don't look at their faces, I encouraged Padma as we made our way to the spot the ocean had selected. Some will cry out, and that's hard to ignore, but try your best just to focus on the song.
Padma shook her head. But I don't know the song.
It just comes, Miyuka explained. She'll tell you when to start, and all you have to do is obey.
I can do that, she said. Just sing?
I nodded. Just sing. The water was lush and warm as we slowed, and Elizabeth led the way, walking up to the surface. The location alone gave away her desperation. There was no storm to call a ship into, nor rocks to crash it on. There was nothing but a beautiful tropical shading of clouds and the long line of the horizon in whichever direction we looked, save the lone silhouette in the distance of the ship that would meet us shortly. Elizabeth turned to Padma.
You all right? I'm scared. I don't want to kill people.
Miyuka came closer to her.
None of us want to. I don't think the ocean even does. But that's how it works. A fraction of lives sustain all the others. It's hard to see the other side of it because you don't face it as closely. But when we get to New York and you walk down the streets for the first time...
Padma grinned, and everything in her demeanor said she still couldn't believe it was real. Miyuka smiled back at her.
Just remember that all the people you pass get to live that day because of the sacrifice you're making right now, both yours and theirs, she said, flicking her head toward the boat.
Padma nodded.
I understand. I'm ready.
We took our places. I lay across the water, the way Aisling had liked to do. Miyuka knelt behind me, fanning out her dress.
You stay with me, Elizabeth said, holding onto Padma's hand. It's okay to feel anxious. Just squeeze my hand and I'll be here.
Okay. I smiled up at Elizabeth, who was too busy looking at Padma to notice. I was sure her wild side was still there, that it had been hibernating on Polly's Island and would roar to life in New York. But it was plain to see the good that Padma brought out in her.
How are you feeling today?
The ocean whispered to me.
Nervous as usual, I admitted. I'm trying to think about what will come next instead of focusing on what's happening now.
Keep trying.
I am.
But already I wondered which voice or face would haunt my dreams, mixing in with the other ghosts that seemed to follow me.
Sing.
I didn't have to look back at Padma. She was safe in Elizabeth's care. As always, the song filled us and spilled into the empty sky, as if we poured tea into a waiting cup, warm and fluid. I watched as the boat deviated from its course, searching for the sound. A few moments later, I was sure whoever was at the helm had spotted the unbelievable mirage.
Four girls, they'd be gasping. Four girls singing on the water.
Out of nowhere, a massive bubble erupted from beneath the water, breaking the surface tension and causing the ship to tilt heavily to one side. There was a single roar of screaming. I plugged my ears and kept singing, trying to speed up the process. It wasn't until the boat was nearly on top of us, listing strangely to the right, that this singing turned into a new kind of nightmare. This wasn't a fishing boat or a ferry. There was a slide on the deck into a pool that was slowly pouring its contents over the side. A rock wall. A movie screen. It was a huge cruise ship. When I focused on the water in front of me, there were so many faces. And they were dressed so elegantly. A young woman in a blue satin gown slid silently beneath the waves, a look of blissful concentration on her face as she listened to our song. Beside her, a man in a tuxedo dived deep and never resurfaced. All around us, people plunged into the water, their fine dresses and slacks seeming grotesque against the backdrop of so much death. But with all that, I didn't realize it was a wedding until I caught sight of the bride. A long white veil floated around her, and her lacy dress was already sodden and heavy with water. Her eyes were fixed on mine, blankly peaceful under the influence of our song. I was sure that she had thought this would be the happiest day of her life, not the last. It was impossible to tell which of the tuxedoed men around her was her groom. Perhaps he had already been swallowed by the waters. Suddenly, I felt nauseated. This bride had found her love, like I had. But there wouldn't be a happy ending for either of us. Shaken, I stopped singing. Even though my sisters continued, my silence brought awareness back into the bride's eyes, and she began to flounder in the water.
Michael!
She called, staring around frantically.
Michael!
She looked at me again, her eyes pleading with mine. I wanted to look away, but I felt like I owed her, as if watching her die dignified it. Tears spilled down my face.
Please,
she said, still staring into my eyes. Her voice was quiet, but it carried across the water, over the voices of my still singing sisters. Mindlessly, I stood and started to walk across the water toward her, clueless as to what I'd do when I got there. Before I could go far, Elizabeth ran up, flattening me on the water. She gripped my hair, turning my face toward hers, and she sang on, all the while staring daggers at me. I thrashed against her arms. Get off me!
Sing.
The ocean's voice was stern and urgent. Elizabeth yanked me back to my feet.
Sing,
she insisted, stopping her own song. Behind her, Mieka's and Padma's voices carried on.
Can't you see? You're making it worse. Sing, end it.
I looked over at the victims of our unfortunate beauty. A few of the wedding guests were coming to their senses in the absence of my and Elizabeth's voices.
Please, Colin, you're putting us all in danger.
I begged the ocean instead.
Save her. There's room for one more.
No wives, no mothers. Would you sentence her to this life?
I could hear the sorrow in her voice. I stopped. No. A century of murder was far crueler than a few moments of fear. I cradled my head over Elizabeth's shoulder and began the song again, Elizabeth's voice weaving with mine. I couldn't bear to watch the people suffering, so instead I focused on Mieka and Padma. There were too many emotions in their faces to read. Sympathy, disappointment, anger, distrust. We sang until the last scream quieted, until the ship was resting on the ocean floor. The silence afterward was razor sharp, far more painful than the screams I'd just endured. Mieka, angrier than I had ever seen her, grabbed me and shook me by the shoulders.
She could have killed you. She's done it for much less. How could you do that to yourself? To us?
This wasn't what I'd been expecting. They were supposed to understand. They were the only ones who could. I closed my eyes. I'm so weary of death.
We're all tired of death,
Elizabeth said, the harshness of her voice shocking me. Tears were running down her face, a thing that never happened, and I was riddled with shame knowing it was because of me. Padma, too, was emotional, probably for her own reasons, and another layer of guilt hit me for adding confusion to her very first sinking. Elizabeth tugged on my arm, bringing back my focus.
But your service to her is almost finished, so do your job.
I waited for the ocean to respond, to tell Elizabeth that, yes, I'd made a mistake, but at least no one lived to tell the tale. Our singing had been successful. But she didn't. I'd never been more alone. I ran and dived, pushing myself up the coast.
I'm sorry.
It doesn't matter, I shot back.
Don't isolate yourself right now. It won't help things.
I sped up, moving as quickly as I could without her help. I can't stand to be with them. I don't even want to be with myself. I've spent so much time talking myself out of the possibility that I'm evil. But it's true. It's the truest thing I know. I was aching. I'd given up so much, and seeing the drowning bride had brought it all home to me. I couldn't be in love. I murdered love every time I sang.
No, you're not evil. You have the softest heart I've ever held. If anything, I'm evil for making you carry this burden.
I blinked back tears and clenched my jaw tightly, hot with anger. You know what? You're right. You are evil. You've taken everything from me. I have no family, no life. I don't even have hope anymore. You killed everything good in me, and I hate you for it. The usually comforting warmth of her embrace felt colder now, as if she was flinching away from me.
I'm sorry for all of it. I'm so sorry.
Get the hell out of my head! I drove myself to the shore, seeing the glow of a lighthouse and using it as my guide to land. I crawled up onto a rocky coast in the fresh darkness of evening. I pulled myself away from the ocean and onto the grass, clutching my knees to my chest, so worn out. I couldn't forget the desperate, pleading look on the bride's face. How many more times would I have to do this? It had been such a long life. I didn't know how much more I could bear, how many more lives I could be responsible for extinguishing. I couldn't forget the faces of the people I'd killed, and I didn't think I could face another 20 years of death. I'd done my best to come to terms with who I was, but never, not once, had I been at perfect peace with myself. What was I supposed to do now? Maybe I should just ask the ocean to end my life. My heart was dying. Maybe my body should as well. I shook my head, ashamed at the thought. What would another death do? There had to be more than this.
Colin?
There were things I thought I might remember if I had a second chance at them. Like, if I could hug my mother again, I hoped that, after everything, I'd be able to recognize her embrace among 100 others. Here it was, as familiar as if I'd lived with it every day. A voice that nothing but the end of my sentence had a chance of erasing from my memory. I turned to the voice, wondering if I was the fairy tale right now, or if he was. 14. I hadn't given any conscious thought to where I was going, but somehow my headlong rush away from my sisters, away from my guilt, had brought me here, Port Clyde, on the coast of Maine, the place where I had longed to be, where it had seemed impossible that I could end up. McKinley emerged from the shadows of the lighthouse, examining me with shock in his weary eyes. It had only been about 6 months since I'd seen him, but he'd changed so much. His scraggly hair was now just a few inches above his shoulders, and he had a hint of a shadow across his chin. His khaki pants had been traded for tattered jeans, and his eyes carried a sadness nearly as heavy as mine.
Are you all right?
Should I be asking you the same thing? I shook my head. I'd never been worse. Dumbfounded, he knelt in front of me as if trying to make sense of my presence. He ran his hands over my arms, checking for injuries. Even as miserable as I was, his concern for me made me feel infinitesimally better.
You're drenched. Did you fall off a boat or something? Please tell me you didn't go for a swim in a prom dress.
I shook my head again.
You don't look like you're bleeding. Do you think you have any broken bones?
No,
How are you even here? I'm so confused.
He continued to stare.
I don't even know what to ask next. Do you have anywhere to go?
No. He poked his fingers into the grass, fidgeting, deciding.
Okay, then. Come with me.
Akinlee rose and held out a hand. I stared at his uncut nails, the dirt still clinging to him. I should not be near this boy. I just committed an act so unspeakable that if I could use my voice, I'd cry for days. I was isolated from my sisters, estranged from the ocean. I was so, so deadly. But what else could I do? Brush him off and say I was fine when I clearly had been through something? Hop into the water, though I couldn't stand to be near her right now? I could stay for a night. Once I was settled, I would come up with a plan. So I slipped my cold hand into his and let him guide me home. I studied Akinlee as we walked. His hand was on my back, leading me to his house, and his palm felt rough and callous, a sign that he was no longer handling books, but something much sturdier. He seemed weathered, less buoyant. Why was he still here? He should have been at school.
It's nice out tonight. You couldn't pick a better evening to go and get yourself lost. I mean, look at that moon. Perfect night for getting lost, don't you think?
I couldn't help but smile. It was as if we hadn't missed a beat. As if I hadn't left him so coldly and vanished without a word.
I've thought about you a lot,
he continued without looking at me.
When you disappeared, I was really worried.
He swallowed.
I tried to find you, but all I had was a first name. The school had no record of anyone going by Colin enrolled as a student, and I couldn't find you online. It was almost like you'd never existed at all. Yet, here you are.
Panic ran through me, my chest tightening. How was I supposed to explain without creating a pit of lies I'd inevitably fall into? I breathed deeply, trying not to lose it. Should I just run? If I disappeared again, I could make sure he never found me. He looked me over. What was he thinking? What was he guessing? Undoubtedly, the truth was too far-fetched for him to imagine. But I sensed he was trying to put all the pieces of my story together, and none of them fit. He finally spoke again, quiet and a little wistful.
I kept hoping you'd come back to the library.
I dropped my eyes and put my hands together in a pleading gesture, trying to make him see how sorry I was, that I hadn't wanted to hurt him.
It's okay, he said, his voice brightening. I wasn't mad. I was worried. It's just nice to know you're not hurt. Well, I hope you're not. Come on.
He turned us toward a two-story house covered in pale blue paint with black shutters. It looked like his only neighbors had settled in for the night, the light of their TV flickering against the curtains. On the other side of his house, the land turned and the road followed. I could hear the sound of waves crashing nearby.
I was sad not to have you around, but I don't blame you for disappearing. I disappeared myself not too long after.
I watched him, confused. What could have happened? We walked up the steps and across the porch, and he drew his hand across his face, as if to wipe away his sorrow.
Julie,
he called, opening the door.
Put on some coffee. We've got company. Julie's my cousin's wife,
he told me.
She was a volunteer EMT in college, so you're in good hands.
The front room of the house was the kitchen, and I wasn't sure who Julie was expecting to see when she rounded in from the living room, but she stopped dead in her tracks when she came upon me. Hi. She looked at Akinlee. Who's this?
Colin. I know her from school, and I found her washed up on the shore by the lighthouse. She doesn't talk.
Julie pointed at my gown. You found her like that?
Yeah.
Her training came out in an instant, and she began feeling my arms and looking at my pupils. She's freezing. She might be in shock. I'll run up and get her some blankets.
Ben, come here!
She called as she raced up the steps. Akinlee moved me to a worn chair in the living room. He pulled open a cupboard and threw a quilt over me,
then went back into the kitchen and fumbled around in a drawer, returning with a pen and paper.
Here, can you tell me what happened?
I gaped at the paper, wondering if an answer might magically appear for me. Finally, I wrote, I don't know.
Don't know or don't know how to say?
I wiggled my hand in front of him, a 50-50 gesture.
Okay. Is there anyone I should call? Family? Friends?
I shook my head.
No one?
I looked down at my hands. I'd gotten myself into a very tricky situation here. How could I explain that no one was looking for me because my only family was a bunch of slightly mythological girls and they knew I couldn't get myself into much more trouble than I was already in? Just then, Julie returned with Ben. I recognized him immediately from the pictures in Akinley's dorm room. He had the same chin and the same eyes, and he used them to look me over, wearing a confused expression as comical as his wife's.
Dude, what the hell?
He said to Akinley.
I didn't do anything. I just found her. I'm trying to figure out how to get her home, but she doesn't seem to remember much. And she's mute, so it's a little complicated.
Julie put her hand on Ben's shoulder.
Maybe we should call the police. I'm sure someone's looking for her.
I shook my head hard, tapped the paper to get their attention, and wrote, Don't bother the police. I'm okay. I stared pleadingly at Julie, understanding that she was acting as a mother in this house. Luckily, her eyes widened in sympathy.
What can we do to help you? She asked. If we can't call the police, can we take you somewhere? A hospital?
I'll be fine, I wrote. I'm just stranded at the moment. I clasped my hands in front of me, thinking, as Julie read what I'd written. I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know how to ask. Akinley scooted around, reading my note over Julie's shoulder.
What if she stayed here with us?
Akinley asked. Julie looked up at him, startled, and Ben frowned.
I'm not sure that's a good idea,
he said in a whisper, as if my muteness also made me deaf.
I'm not comfortable with a stranger in the house.
But she's not a stranger, Akinley said. I told Julie. We know each other from school. Look, I even...
He pulled out his phone, fumbling with buttons.
See? That's her.
I'd almost forgotten about the one picture I'd sent him, snuggled and half hidden in my bed. Ben made a face, agreeing that I was in fact the same girl. While he was clearly still skeptical, Julie seemed mollified.
Are you sure you'll be okay here?
She asked me.
Don't you have somewhere to be?
This all felt incredibly awkward, inviting myself into their home. But I didn't see another option at this point. I couldn't just walk out into the night as if nothing had happened, and I couldn't let them hand me over to a police officer or a paramedic. And it was highly unlikely that I'd ever get to spend a night under the same roof as Akinley ever again. I shook my head and wrote, I'd like to stay, if you didn't mind, just for a night. She frowned worriedly, clearly still concerned, but nodded.
If that's all we can do for you.
I still felt tender and fragile, haunted by what I'd done, but I looked at Akinley and smiled. After some debate over where to put me, Julie decided I should sleep in the spare room, and she set about making up the sofa bed, then brought me a pair of pajamas. I was grateful for something to wear that wasn't made of ocean, despite them looking a little too big. There are more blankets in this closet if you need them. Even though it's spring, it can get cold up this far north. Not sure if you're from Florida or not, so, yeah. Julie stammered, filling the uncomfortable space with words. Also, I put a cup and a new toothbrush in the downstairs bathroom for you. If you think of anything you need, just let someone know.
I nodded, grateful for her kindness.
The true gift she gave me was time, but that she thought of a dozen other niceties made me feel incredibly fond of her. She nodded and then placed her hands on her hips.
This is a bit weird, isn't it?
She asked, gesturing to us and the room.
I grimaced and nodded. Well, weirdness aside, you can stay here as long as you need. Any friend of Akinley's is a friend of ours. Haven't seen too many of them lately.
She admitted sadly.
So you're a welcome change.
Julie smiled, and I had a feeling that she and I were on the same side, for at least the time being, and that made me like her even more. I'll let you get ready for bed. Good night. When she closed the door, I looked out the wide window that faced the ocean. She was calling out to me.
Where are you? Are you all right?
I rolled my eyes. It wasn't as if I could die. She knew that. So I ignored her and slipped into Julie's pajamas, pausing to roll up the legs. I emerged from the room to find Akinley on the couch, in pajamas of his own. I was so happy to see him waiting for me.
Hey,
he said, standing.
We've got food if you want.
I signed no, forgetting he didn't know sign language. But he remembered the gesture from our one date and continued.
Okay, do you want to watch some TV? If you're tired, you can just go to bed, but I was going to sit here for a while.
In the light of the lamp, I noticed the shadows under Akinley's eyes. He looked much older and more experienced than he had 6 months ago, but the same warm acceptance shone in his gaze. I couldn't stay, I reminded myself. I would have to leave tomorrow, go back to my sister's. I could only allow myself one day with him. I didn't want to go to bed. I wanted to spend every ordinary moment I could with Akinley. Maybe I could pretend, just for tonight. I nodded, and we settled onto the couch together. I pulled into a ball to cover myself up. I felt so insecure in Julie's clothes. Akinley mistook this posture for coldness and pulled a blanket off the back of the couch and messily spread it over me. He hardly even acknowledged that he'd done it, just swept it down and picked up the remote again, making the volume louder. The channel was clearly sports-focused, and the current game featured giant men in tight clothes. Akinley noticed my puzzled expression and laughed.
It's a strongman competition. These things crack me up.
We watched as men carried refrigerators, lifted huge boulders, and flipped massive tires in strange races. I watched, slack-jawed, as the competitions got more and more bizarre. By the time the first man came up to pull an 18-wheeler into motion from a standstill, I was pointing at the screen, shaking my fingers wildly. I couldn't believe any human was that strong.
I know, he cried out. It's crazy.
I nodded, a giddy smile on my face. Watching TV had never felt so normal. After a few contests, he lowered the sound. He seemed nervous, flicking his eyes between the television and me as he started his questions.
Have you been okay? Since October?
He handed the pen and paper back to me, but this was one of those things that was beyond words. I wobbled my head back and forth, trying to say a little yes and a little no.
I got nervous when you just turned into a ghost.
He flicked his fingers open as if I were a flash of smoke. Again, there was nothing I could say to this. Akinley fidgeted in his seat, finally pushing himself to where he was mostly facing me.
Okay, I realize that you're kind of stuck here tonight, so maybe it's unfair to ask, but I just have to know. Did I do something wrong?
I shook my head adamantly.
Are you sure? Because I thought we were having a great night, and then you were gone, and I have played that date over and over in my head trying to figure out what I did.
I sighed, setting the pad straight in my hand. The pen hung for a long time as I considered my words. It definitely wasn't you. He squinted.
Did someone else that night bother you? I know they were a crazy bunch, but...
I shook my head again, pointing the pen at my chest.
So what, you just had to go?
I nodded, a little embarrassed. He squinted.
So it was you? You alone? No one else made you go?
I swallowed. The ocean's rules were the catalyst, and her deeply possessive nature was in the back of my mind. But it had been my idea, right? After some consideration, he pursed his lips as if he was storing this information.
You know, there's something else,
he said solemnly.
You never told me your favorite color before you left.
I grinned and shook my head at this ridiculous boy. So many, but mostly I like the color of autumn.
The color of autumn,
he repeated slowly.
Yeah, how everything looks like it's on fire.
But it's dying. Death never looked so lovely. He chuckled.
Excellent point. I like a good blue myself. Maybe because I grew up on the water. What else? Favorite food?
I made a face. Cake, obviously.
Oh, I can't believe I missed that. And by the way, a few months ago I was in a store and saw how expensive almond extract was. We should have been charging per slice. Yikes.
Nah, I was happy to share.
Well, maybe we should have been less eager. I got harassed for more treats up until the day I left. Seriously. So, just so you know, you broke the heart of the entire second floor in Jappison Hall when you left. They were crushed over the loss of cake.
I appreciated Akinley's teasing. I had been afraid that he'd be mad or bitter. Knowing that he'd mostly been worried made being back beside him so easy. Too easy.
Oh, here's a good one. I think this says a lot about a person. Favorite smell.
I considered for a moment.
I'll go first if you like. I love the smell of fresh cut grass.
I gave him a thumbs up because that was a good one.
I heard that the smell is actually the grass trying to say it's in distress, which makes me a little sad about it. But it's still really good.
I took up my pad. So what does that say about you? Enjoys the outdoors, yearns for freedom, willingly mows lawns? He laughed.
All of the above. What about you?
I flipped to the next page. It wasn't until I started writing it down that I realized the memory had even stayed with me. It was like a special gift after all this time. Any flowers. My mother used to like to have fresh flowers in the house.
So not even specific, just any flower at all?
I nodded. Akinley's smile faded as he read over the page again.
Wait a minute. Used to? She doesn't anymore?
I closed my eyes, realizing I'd been thoughtless. I hadn't intended to let him know that.
Is your mom gone?
Looking down at my hands so I wouldn't be drawn to lie, I nodded.
Your dad?
I nodded again.
How?
He breathed, as if he was almost afraid to ask. I felt numb for a minute, recalling the carpet and my mother watching herself in a mirror as the boat heaved. They drowned. I'd said the words before, but I'd never written them down. It was much harder to face in print. I preferred to think of it as an accident, though the images of murder at the ocean's hands or suicide at their own were the ones that tried to force their way to the front. He let out a breathy sound, almost like a laugh.
That's crazy.
There was a long pause as he sat there, staring at anything in the room but me.
A few weeks after you left, I got a call from my mom, which, you know, was no surprise because she called me every day. But even from her saying hello, I knew something was wrong.
He paused to swallow and started toying with a thread on the couch.
She had cancer. It was pretty serious, and I wanted to go home right away. They wanted me to finish the year, so we compromised, and I went home at Christmas break. Dad was adamant that I was going back to school. I wasn't sure I could, even after whatever happened with Mom. I didn't want to leave him alone, you know?
He looked up at me, and I gave a tiny nod. I did. I understood what it meant to stay.
I was supposed to be with them,
he said. It was all he could get out before looking away again. He tried not to make a big deal of wiping away the tears in his eyes.
Mom had a doctor's appointment, and Dad was taking her. I was going to go too, but Mom, I'll never forget it. She told me to stay. Every time I tried to argue about it, she insisted I stay. Sometimes I wonder if she knew.
He stared at nothing, haunted.
It was rainy,
he continued.
The roads here can flood sometimes if it gets bad. The police weren't sure if my dad saw a deer or just hit a bad patch, but he swerved right into a tree.
I covered my mouth, eyes brimming.
I'd been bracing myself for Mom, but losing them both at once? I wasn't ready for that.
I crawled across the couch, sitting next to him, scribbling on the pad. I should have been with mine, too. He squinted.
Did you nearly drown?
I nodded. He sighed.
Looks like you nearly drowned again tonight.
He wiped at a tear in the corner of my eye.
Seems like water isn't your friend.
I tried to control my face, not wanting to give away that water was so much more and so much less than that. We were getting into dangerous territory here, a place where I couldn't keep my secrets. And Akinlee looked incredibly tired, and I felt guilty keeping him up any later. So I pointed to the clock, to myself, and then to my room, letting him off the hook.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Though he seemed as hesitant to part ways as I was. I crossed to the guest room, hearing Akinlee stand as I reached the door.
Will you be okay alone? I could sit with you if you want. I know it's been a crazy night.
He brushed his too long hair out of his face, and I stared into his beautiful blue eyes. It had been hard enough to talk myself out of liking him 6 months ago, but now, seeing him so typical, so at home, so very human, it was almost impossible to think about walking out the door tomorrow. But of course, I'd have to. And eventually, I'd have to go back to the ocean. I still owed her 19 years. Who would he be in 19 years? A husband? A father? And what would I be? A teenage girl who'd spent the last century killing and running, now penniless, nameless, and pointless. I signed no, snapping my fingers together, and it was a relief that there was one word between the two of us that needed no translation.
Okay, well, I'll be out here if you need me.
I nodded.
And hey,
he added quickly, shoving his hands into the pockets of his sweatpants.
Even though the circumstances are weird, it's nice to see you again.
I smiled as I turned and went into the room. Without Akinlee's jokes and laughs to distract me, I could once again hear the ocean calling for my return. Just a few hundred feet from the water, I was too far away for her to find me.
Where are you? Your sisters are worried. Come back. Colin, come back.
I lay on my bed, listening to her go on and on. The anxious tone implied her wringing her hands and pacing, like a mother who'd lost her child in a crowd. Well, maybe now she could understand how all the friends and relatives of the people she'd devoured over the years had felt. Besides, she was being dramatic. Where could I go? It wasn't as if I could die without her help.
Come back. Where have you gone? Why aren't you answering?
She pleaded endlessly with me. I would. Of course I would. What else could I do? I heard the door to the spare room creak and pretended to be asleep, hoping I could pull off looking like a normal person for just a few more hours. I felt a warm hand touch my forehead, and then my cheek. I held my act steady, though Akinlee's touch made me feel more than awake.
Where in the world did you come from, you beautiful, silent girl?
He whispered. After a long moment, I heard him slowly creep out of the room, quietly closing the door behind him. I pressed my lips together, wanting to cry. He touched me before in passing, but that brush against my cheek was so incredibly tender, it was almost impossible to take. In my first life, I'd never crossed paths with anyone I wanted to be with, and I had no promise that I would once my sentence was up. So why, here and now, in this frozen, useless time, did someone have to make me feel this way? I couldn't keep him, and I couldn't even be sure how deep his feelings went, though I sensed he was as curious about me as I was about him. This was bound to be a disaster. I couldn't stay forever, but at least I could stay for a day. 15. When the sun came up, I was still awake, thinking of Akinlee's callous fingers on my cheek. I heard the others waking and moving around in the kitchen. I sat up, staring out the window. The ocean continued her cries, but I wasn't ready to face her yet, or to leave Akinlee.
So I'll be on the boat till the afternoon, and I need to talk to Evan,
Ben was talking with his mouth full.
I'll go out tomorrow, McKinley promised. I mean, we've been hitting our numbers. It's no big deal. I know you're indisposed today.
I smirked to myself. For one day, McKinley belonged to me. The noise settled down. Doors opened and closed.